Our fourth case for this morning is Coleman v. Department of Labor Review Commission. Mr. Crum. Let your opponent get settled in for a second. Okay, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Magistrate judges lack the protections of Article 3, and therefore Section 636 conditions their authority on the consent of the parties.
So how do you think this should have gone forward? This is, of course, not even really a 12b-6. This is screening for inform of pauperous treatment. Do you think that once the magistrate judge gets the consent from the plaintiff and looks at it and says, this looks like a case that's going nowhere, he kicks it over to the district court judge?
I think that there are three ways this could happen, Your Honor. The first is that these types of cases could simply be assigned to a district judge in the first instance. That's how some districts do it.
Until both consents come in would be your view.
Correct.
Because we, of course, have the first consent.
Correct. We have Mr. Coleman's consent on the record. Another option would be what you suggested, which is that the magistrate judge basically treats this as a 636B referral, and the district judge is the one that actually enters final judgment. A final option would be to just delay the screening process until after the defendant has been served and has consented to the court's jurisdiction.
That seems, because your opponents are making a practical argument, basically saying who's hurt, you know, in the screening situation when the case gets sort of cut off at the knees before it ever even gets to the defendants. Is there room for that kind of argument in your view, or is that impermissible given Wellness and, you know, various other Supreme Court cases about Article III judges?
I don't believe that the inquiry here is whether or not there was a harm to the defendant. The jurisdiction of the courts is something that this court can raise on its own instance. In fact, this court or any court cannot assume that it has jurisdiction and then enter a decision on the merits. It must affirmatively make that determination. So the arguments that the commission makes as to whether or not they were harmed by the screening process, I think, are somewhat irrelevant. We did identify some harms in our reply brief. I think that there are many individuals who would like to know that a lawsuit has been filed against them. If you are a prison guard or a police officer and an inmate or a suspect has filed a claim against you, you might want to know that because it's relevant to your employment. Similarly, for a doctor who has been sued on a malpractice claim by a patient, I think many people would want to know that that has occurred. And as we discussed in our reply brief, certain principles of issue preclusion only attach once service of process has happened. So while we disagree with them about whether or not there is a harm to the defendant, I agree with your suggestion, Judge Wood, that that is not the proper inquiry here. The proper inquiry is whether or not the magistrate judge had the authority under Section 636C. And if the magistrate judge did not have that authority, it was improper for him to step into the role of an Article III judge and enter final judgment in this case. And one indication that we have that the magistrate judge overstepped his authority is Congress's selection and differentiation between the words party and parties. Now, the commission points
what is the bad consequence of what the judge did, the magistrate judge did?
I think the bad
consequence. Are you objecting to it?
I think that there is a harm to the judiciary that occurs.
Harm to the judiciary? What are you talking about?
I think that there is a harm that occurs when any actor assumes the role of an Article III judge when they have not been appointed by the president.
Why?
Confirmed by the Senate.
When you're dismissing the case, which is fine with the defendant, obviously. The defendant doesn't care whether it's done by a magistrate judge or Article III judge. What's the harm?
Well, to argue by analogy, if a district judge...
I don't want an argument by analogy. I want you to tell me what the harm is.
I think the harm, and this goes back to when the Federal Magistrate Act was passed in 1979, and as this court stated in its Jarris opinion in the 1980s, that the entry of final judgment by a magistrate judge is the most constitutionally suspect aspect.
Why?
Because that is the one thing that actually closes the case. It terminates an action. It prevents Mr. Coleman from proceeding with his claim.
Well, maybe your answer is that maybe you can't identify a harm, but the Supreme Court has taken a formalistic approach to this. And the Supreme Court has said, whether in wellness or whether in you know, the case of, you know, the Ninth Circuit trying to use a territorial judge, or whether voir dire in felony cases or what have you, that there are a certain number of things for perhaps purely formal reasons have to happen before an Article III judge. I mean, I'm not sure that you can answer the harm question, to be honest, because I'm sure, I mean, we have very good magistrate judges. You could probably have the magistrate judges handling a great number of trials even without consent, and I would be hard-pressed to say that there was harm in that either if I was thinking of competence.
Those aren't cases involving dismissal before the defendant is served, does it?
Sorry, I didn't hear your question, yes, sir.
Are those cases involving dismissal before the defendant is served?
I believe the cases that Judge Wood was articulating, for instance, the Nguyen case is a case where the Ninth Circuit invited a, I believe it was the chief judge of the District Court of the Northern Mariana Islands to hear a case from the District Court of Guam. And the Supreme
Court...
But
isn't this case unusual?
This case is different from those cases.
I mean,
cases.
It's not like the magistrate judge delivering a judgment at the end of a trial or anything like that, right?
But it's a merits
without
judgment,
consent,
right?
The parties, right?
Yeah. Yes, it is a merits judgment. It
And it's more, to me, of a case management issue from the magistrate standpoint, because what's the point of going through the cost of service to a defendant when... Right.
You're saying he wouldn't have to do that if he just gave it to the district judge and said, I need you to enter this order. Mm-hmm. You know, a very brief one-paragraph report and recommendation saying... So the defendant is still spared service, being annoyed by the case, etc. It's just that an Article III judge. I think it's a very formalistic rule myself. I think if you got into harm, you would have a difficult time reconciling the other cases. I don't know what the harm of a magistrate judge doing felony voir dire is either. They do a fine job.
Well, I agree with the suggestion that this is largely a question about case management. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in many district courts around the country, there are essentially pro se law clerks who are not assigned to any particular judge, who screen these types of cases and make recommendations. And motions panels handle these types of things at the Court of Appeals level. And at the district court level, I think that in a situation like here, where there has not been service of process, in order to avoid any type of concerns under either Article III or Section
630.
To avoid any constitutional concerns under Article III, or to avoid problems under Section 636C.
So what does Article III have to do with it?
Well, I think Article III has to do with this case because when Congress enacted the Federal Magistrate Act, it realized that it was vastly expanding the authority of non-Article III adjudicators to do things like entering final judgments.
Well, the Supreme Court has talked about that, right?
Indeed, in the Royal decision.
But in a case like this, has it?
The Supreme Court has not addressed the screening situation.
So why not distinguish those cases from ones in which the defendant hasn't been served and you want to get rid of the case?
I don't think those cases are necessarily distinguishable because of the very clear text of the statute here. Congress was very purposeful when it selected the term parties as opposed to party. Every time Congress uses the term parties in the statute, it's linked to notions of consent. And likewise, every time the term consent is used, it's linked to the plural form of parties.
But it sounds so pointless.
I don't believe it's, even if it is pointless, Your Honor, I think that is the rule that Congress has laid down.
I don't like that. Well, so pointless rules, pointless formalities, just slows everything up.
Well, so for instance,
and there's no point. There ought to be a point. I mean, the law ought to have some function rather than just being a collection of formalisms.
Well, I do think that jurisdiction as sort of a body of law is largely a collection of formalisms. For instance, if a plaintiff fails to appeal something within the 30 or 60-day appeal deadline and appeals on the 31st day or the 61st day, there isn't necessarily any harm there in terms of, oh, they got one extra day to write their brief, but the Supreme Court has instructed in the Ballas versus Russell case that you cannot hear that lawsuit, that a court of appeals lacks jurisdiction over that. So even though there's not necessarily a harm to the defendant, I think there are rules that courts need to follow, because in order to have any type of notion of rule of law or authority to decide things, we need to have very clear jurisdictional rules.
And there's no carve-out in 636C for a situation like our situation, or the situation in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Nitzke decision, which the Commission cites and we cite in our reply brief, notes that the screening process has existed since the Federal Magistrate Act was initially passed. It's undergone some changes and some evolutions since then, but that screening process was in place. So Congress was presumably aware that the IFP process worked in this regard. And if it wanted to create a carve-out where for IFP cases or for screening, magistrate judges could enter final judgment, it could have done so. And you know, we see in the legislative history of the Federal Magistrate Act of 1979 that there were proposals in Social Security review cases and FTCA cases to allow magistrate judges to enter final judgment without the consent of the parties. Those are sort of the public rights cases that that you see sort of used to see as an exception to the Article III rules. And Congress decided against allowing magistrate judges to enter final judgment in those cases because of the uproar from the Federal Bar Association and other entities that thought that these types of judgments...
An uproar from the... What is that about?
Well, uproar might be the wrong term, but there was a hearing.
Firm opposition, I think, is what you want to say. Yes. That's all right.
Vigorous opposition.
Why? What was the basis of it?
It was the Article III concerns that I was mentioning earlier, and I think in the 1970s there was a concern that the caseload of the federal judiciary was increasing exponentially compared to past decades, and there was a fear that because not enough Article III judges were being confirmed, that the judiciary would be swallowed up by magistrate judges who would basically become adjuncts right. And would be running
There was a lot of
true.
Heated rhetoric
there
floating
there was,
around
I mean,
that time.
Just in terms of whether or not magistrates could be members of the judicial conference, whether mm-hmm. they could be on judicial conference committees. I mean,
they were lobbying
lots
for
of,
the term magistrate
exactly,
judge instead
exactly.
of being called
so
magistrate.
So this all came out in that context.
Exactly, Your Honor. And, you know, we've become somewhat normalized and habituated to it today that magistrate judges are treated as sort of functional equivalents of Article III judges when you have a Section 636C referral. But I still think we need to respect the line that Congress drew. And this type of slow creep into the areas like entering final judgment, as what happened here that occurred, are the types of things that Congress was concerned about. And even though it is largely formalistic, I think it is the type of formalistic rule that this court should follow. If there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Apparently that would be fine. Good morning, Mr. Russomanno.
Good morning. I represent the state defendant in this matter, and
we appreciate your appearance since, your client has not been served, as we know.
I'm Assistant Attorney General Anthony Russomanno, who, if there were to be a defendant in the trial court,
it would be you.
Well, they're your client, I suppose. They just aren't involved in this case formally at this moment.
Correct. Right. Our understanding is we're here at an invitation from the court to help give perspective on this jurisdictional issue primarily. And as our brief attempts to convey is, we would urge the court to take a pragmatic approach. We think that the relevant statute and case law allows it, and we think the screening context, and really this is only about the screening context,
I don't see where the statute allows it, though. I mean, I certainly take the point that we're discussing a formal rule, not something that is a pragmatic rule, because if we went down the pragmatic line, I might be delighted to give the magistrate judges a great number of cases, because I think they are fine. They're just like everybody else. But if you look at 636, it lays out quite carefully what the authorities of the magistrate judges are going to be in 636A, and it also provides for the consents. And so I think one of the questions is, what's the starting point? Is it they can act unless the authority is taken away from them, or is it they can't act unless the authority is given to them? Because if it's the first of those, your argument might be correct. But if it's understood that you have to use an Article III judge unless there's permission in 636 somewhere, I don't see the permission. Even though screening is a preliminary thing, it can yield a judgment on the merits, namely dismissal for failure to state a claim.
Well, Your Honor, we think, at least where we would locate it, is there would be permission, there would be authority in the statute.
What language of the statute are you looking at?
That's under sub C, sub 1.
So you think consent of the parties, plural, means under the Dictionary Act, consent of the party, singular. But I have a contextual problem with that, given the way this statute operates. It seems to me that the idea is everybody has to be okay with it, and you aren't there yet. So, I mean, obviously there are all sorts of things in the federal rules and in the statutes that acknowledge party status to people who aren't served yet. Throw Rule 4 away if that weren't the case, and certainly other rules as well. So I guess in the face of ambiguity, which way do you go? Or it's not even ambiguity. With the lack of you know, a section in A, you know, adding to the list in A, number 6, the power to dismiss a case upon IFP screening, you know, that would be fine if that were there, and maybe that would be consistent with the Constitution for all I know. But the Supreme Court has been very fussy about this area over the years. That's what worries me about your position.
Sure, Your Honor, and well, maybe I'll take, I think there's a couple of questions there. The first one is, we would say that the term parties, and I think this is supported by the case law and the Dictionary Act, can mean party. So when you see the word parties, it can be read as a singular if it makes sense in context. And so we propose that it does make sense in the present context of screening for the reasons we discussed.
But it doesn't make sense. You would have to actually say in C1 that there was sort of an implicit clause at the end that says, whenever other parties haven't been served, because you would agree, I take it, that if everybody's been served, the word parties in C1 has to mean everyone.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're embroidering this with a lot of extra language.
I suppose that's one way of looking at it, Your Honor. I think another way, perhaps, is that you would read upon consent of the party, right, and then the next applicable phrase would be may conduct any or all proceedings at the screening phase, which is a proceeding of this, of
so
a sort.
So you have to add at the screening phase because you need everybody's consent after screening is over. It's just a lot of, I mean, I called it embroidery. I mean, there's, however sensible it may be, that's not what this sentence says. And if you use the word party and parties plural to mean party singular, you don't want to do that. Take it. You don't want to do that to undo the normal 636C process. Your clients, the state of Wisconsin, other people are sued all the time, and you want to have your say about whether it's going to be a district court judge or a magistrate judge.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think, and maybe and this is, the nuance of our argument, that you wouldn't interpret party or parties singular or plural for all circumstances one way or the other. It would change. Sometimes it would be plural, sometimes singular.
Isn't that a little unsettling?
Well, I think it's the nature of party, the word party, and I think that some of the cases talk about that as it is something that can mean all kinds of things. You can be
a
party.
Has this been done in other cases?
The interpretation of a party, Your Honor?
No, what was done here? The magistrate judge dismissing a case because the defendant hadn't been served. Is this first case to do this?
No, Your Honor. So if I understand your question
correctly.
Because,
you know, one of the provisions of the statute says a magistrate judge may be assigned such additional duties as are not inconsistent with the Constitution, and each district judge shall establish rules, etc., etc. Is it possible to argue that the court, Eastern District of Wisconsin, has tacitly tacitly authorized the magistrate judges to do this?
I think actually, I don't know if it's in this record, but I think it's true that you have to authorize the magistrate to do this at all. So as part of the initial language we're looking at, it has to be specifically designated to exercise just such jurisdiction by the district court. So the Article III judge has to decide to empower the magistrate, and then the party or parties would consent. So, and if I could pivot back to Judge Wood's question on the Supreme Court's concerns and perhaps if the Article III issue, we don't think there is one, and we think that
Well, why was there an Article III issue in Wynn? I mean, that case had an had a territorial judge, only one. It was a panel of three judges. As far as I know, that I, you know, what was the harm?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a different circumstance, and I'll try to explain why.
I understand that, but the very same arguments can be made about that as we're discussing here. I know Article IV judges aren't the same as Article I judges, but there are similarities. It's not an Article III judge.
That's
right. The
Supreme
Court got all fussy about it and said, no, you know, you can't have anybody but an Article III judge on this panel of the Ninth Circuit.
And some of the distinction might be this, and so I'll take it in two steps. First is that I don't think there's a disagreement on this, that your right to an Article III judge is for the most part personal. And the cases talk about that, the Wellness International case, the Garris case from this court, it's usually mm-hmm. personal. Mm-hmm. So if you consent, then usually that answers the Article III question. There's some talk that you could go too far and say Congress could create a system where you do start running afoul of separation of powers issues, where they're taking something away from the judiciary, what they should be doing. And I think that framework when that line would be crossed isn't here. And that's because the magistrates are hired by the district judges. They can be fired by them. And as we just discussed, the district judge, the Article III judge, has to decide to then give these duties to the magistrate, and then a party or parties would have to consent. There's a lot of built-in protections both for the Article III court and the parties in this system for the magistrates. That I don't think would necessarily parallel in every respect the example you were giving, Your Honor.
Okay. But has this happened before? I mean, this dismissal before the defendant served in Wisconsin.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the district judges know about this, presumably.
Presumably, Your Honor.
They haven't stepped in and said we didn't authorize you to do this.
That's right, Your Honor. And I would, and there's some cases in the briefs that there's this court's Haynes case, which was under 1915A for inmates, but it has the same screening mechanism in the current.
Yeah, it was there was the one other case in which is something we called, I think, to the party's attention in the briefing order.
And the Niels case, which is a different circuit, but there's also the Haynes case in this circuit that discussed
right.
the issue. It acknowledges the issue and says, okay, there's not a deep analysis of it, but.
I don't think it was looked at all that carefully, actually, at the time. So, in any event, we're looking at it now, so we're listening to you.
So, I'll talk a bit about our big picture argument, and we have it in the brief, so I won't belabor it. But the idea that at screening is special in the sense that it's not like a normal dispute where the defendant can lose anything at screening. If you get past screening, then the defendant has all their defenses, can answer, can move to dismiss, can do all the things you'd normally do as a party.
But the commencement date, even in a case that has to be screened for purposes of, did you file in time for the statute of limitations or triggering various other obligations, is the date of filing, not the date when the district court decides that you can proceed after screening.
That would have to be right, Your Honor. I assume for reasons of fairness, but I haven't independently
right.
researched
that. Right, because the plaintiff has no ability to control how long it takes the district court judge to get it, or the magistrate judge, whoever's screening,
correct,
to
Your
get
Honor.
The job done.
Sure. But I would point out that maybe for other purposes, in the sense of when a defendant comes in and a complaint is filed in that sense, I believe this court's Hutchinson v. Spink case discusses that a complaint is filed in that sense.
For triggering
screening.
The length of time you have to answer. That's
so
right.
that other sense of filing mm-hmm. is after the screening process. And I'd like to briefly touch on a couple points that my opponent raises, and that is posits that a defendant really does want to be involved in screening, they just don't know it, or they might be in some future case. Just to clarify, this court's cases talk about screening as preclusive. I believe the court would put it more in an issue preclusive sort of sense. So you can't just keep going through this 1915 process of screening over and over again. If you're dismissed at screening, there is a preclusive effect, and that's in the Gladney case that's cited.
No, we've definitely said that. I think actually the situation I've worried about more is if the district court judge, and let's just say the district court institutionally, no matter who it is, the magistrate judge, Article III judge, screens and says, yeah, it looks like there's something here. Now the defendant gets served, and the defendant has already lost a 12B6 motion before ever having the chance to say anything about it. And some prisoners and others actually file cases that survive screening.
Right, and I understand your point as being practical. Of course, the defendant still could move to dismiss. But
you've got, I mean, not to use a baseball metaphor on such a fraught day, but you, you've got a couple of strikes against you.
Sure, but there's also, and I would be speaking just from experience, but I know people do file motions to dismiss after screening, and I've won one.
Okay.
So you might, the attorney might see
something. So it's only two strikes, it's not all three.
Yeah. Yeah. The attorney might see something that wasn't there before. If it wasn't addressed, then they're free to raise it, and it's possible to succeed on that.
Right.
But often, you're right, they'll see the writing on the wall. But maybe that's helpful. Maybe that doesn't waste time then with the motion and moves on to summary judgment or what have you. And the other, this is more of a nuanced point that I wanted to just make sure was clear in case it comes up in the court's decision, is that there's some distinctions made in my opponent's brief between the PLRA, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and the informal PAPRA screening process. And just to make the point is that the PLRA actually amended both. So it created these inmate-specific provisions, but it also created the 1915E provisions we're talking about here for informal PAPRA plaintiffs. And to change it so that it's mandatory dismissal based on failure to state a claim.
Right.
So it's actually the same statute that did both of these things. And that might matter to this court's analysis of the Haynes case. If that this court were wondering whether to follow Haynes, one of this court's cases, I don't know that there's a good way to distinguish Haynes based on the inmate versus not inmate. I think either Haynes is right for screening or it isn't, would be what we propose. I won't get into whether Mr. Coleman stated a claim. I think that's in our brief to the extent it needs to be, but I'm happy to take questions on that if the court wishes.
I don't think that's, unless somebody's interested, that's not necessary.
Okay, well, and if there's no further questions, I'll sit down.
All right, thank you very much. We appreciate your coming. And Mr. Crum.
Thank you. I'd like to make 2 points in my rebuttal time. The first is to address the question of whether or not this has happened in other cases. And as we've discussed throughout the briefs in this case, this court has had two decisions that are somewhat in tension with one another. The first is the Genie case, which was from 1985. And there the court dealt with the situation where not all the defendants had been served. And this court refused to infer consent and refused to take jurisdiction over the case because of constitutional overtones. And then later, as the commission mentions, there's the Haynes case, which is a 1997 case under the PLRA, where without even mentioning the Genie case, this court exercised jurisdiction over the merits and said that, you know, consent was not necessary because it was for the limited purpose of the Spears hearing and the screening procedures. So to the extent that there is a tension between these cases, I would argue that the prior case, the Genie case, is the one that controls because it's earlier in time, and that Haynes sort of departed without acknowledging that it was departing from that precedent. And going outside of the Seventh Circuit, both the Fifth and the Eighth Circuits have addressed similar questions. In the Niels decision, which this court's
clerks... What would be the difference between having the magistrate judge acting, ruling in this case, or a district judge?
It might not matter for the actual result, but, you know, you could see situations in
which... Would it matter for anything?
I think it matters as to what authority the magistrate judge has under Section 636C.
What difference does it make?
I think it's all just really...
pointless formality.
I, in some ways, jurisdictional statutes are formalities, but I do think
usually there's some kind of logic to them, right?
What's the
logic here?
I think that the logic here is that Congress was concerned that magistrate judges would take on too many responsibilities.
Congress obviously didn't foresee this situation.
I think it's there's no indication that Congress foresaw the screening situation, but Congress did foresee things like Social Security reviews, FTCA cases, and those are the types of things that, in many instances, magistrate judges would handle today, and Congress said you still need to have consent to enter final judgment there. And so to just go quickly back to the other circuit cases, I would just point the court to the Henry case out of the Eighth Circuit. I think there the Eighth Circuit took the appropriate approach and determined that consent was necessary. And the thing that I'd like to close on is just what the appropriate disposition here is, because we argue in our brief that vacature is the appropriate disposition, because although this court has said in some cases that a de facto report and recommendation remains pending in the district court, there's two problems with that here. The first is that there's actually no district judge assigned to this case that would necessarily be one who could get the objections to that report and recommendation. And finally, any time period.
Well, did you ask for one?
No, but no district judge was ever assigned by the clerk's office. So if you look at the last
no district judges what?
Was ever assigned to this case by the clerk's office.
It came straight up here from the magistrate judge.
Correct. Correct.
Well, did you ask for a district judge to?
Mr. Coleman was proceeding pro se below, and so he did not ask for one, but obviously if given the opportunity, we would ask for one. And just to make my final point, if I may, the time period, the 14-day time period to file objections to reports or recommendation has passed, so that's why we believe that vacature is the appropriate remedy here, so that that can't be used against Mr. Coleman. Thank you.
All right, thank you, and thank you as well, Mr. Crum, for you and your firm for accepting our invitation to take this case on, so we actually have a lot to thank for in both sides of this case and for excellent presentations. We will take the case under advisement.